1947. But the technology was evolving rapidly and enabling feats of special effects that filmmakers previously could only dream of. Willow, 1988, saw the first use of digital morphing. A character under a spell turned into various animals. James Cameron's The Abyss, 1989, marked the first time computer-generated aliens had mingled with human actors, albeit for a 5-minute sequence. But there was no missing the groundbreaking ILM effects in Cameron's next blockbuster, Terminator 2, 1991, in which the T-1000 assassin from the future repeatedly turns himself into a sinister silver ooze of liquid metal. Meanwhile, Dennis Muren, one of the few veterans of the original Star Wars and lead effects producer at ILM, was hard at work on a project for Steven Spielberg. The director had optioned Michael Crichton's novel Jurassic Park. Spielberg assumed he would have to go with animatronic or go-motion dinosaurs. Muren's job was to prove him wrong, and he had a secret weapon, state-of-the-art animation hardware from Silicon Graphics. In 1993, ILM and Silicon Graphics, also called SGI, inked a deal called Joint Environment for Digital Imaging, or JEDI, which essentially gave Lucas SGI workstations at cost. It's fair to say the prequels would never have been made without JEDI. In 1992, when Spielberg and Lucas gathered to watch the result of Muren's labor, wireframe dinosaurs running realistically across a screen, everyone had tears in their eyes, Lucas said 2 years later. His reaction? We may have reached a level here where we actually artificially created reality, which is, of course, what movies were trying to do all along. His only concern was that the dinosaurs might look clumsy in 20 years' time. They don't. Lucas's friendly rivalry with Spielberg was tilting toward Spielberg again. Jurassic Park was obviously going to be a huge hit, and a landmark in CGI. It would have been natural for Lucas to feel the need to one-up his friend again. Luckily, Lucas's spirit of filmmaking adventure was back, spurred on by the Young Indiana Jones TV series. In development from 1989 and filmed from 1991 to 1993, the show was a tremendously happy experience for Lucas, despite its untimely cancellation. Not only did it fill in a lot of the backstory for one of his best-known creations, call it the indie prequels, but it was also a great chance to provide viewers with some lighthearted education, which was catnip for the creator. Each week, young Indy would meet another famous historical figure. The episodes were relatively cheap compared to movies, costing $1.5 million each. Each one would be a proving ground for digital special effects shots, of which there were around 100 per episode. Awaiting the pitch at ABC was a former TV weather reporter turned chair of the company, Bob Iger. Young Indy marked the first time Lucas had gathered a team that used Skywalker Ranch the way it was intended. It was one of the closest things in his career to the small-scale filmmaking he'd long talked about getting back to. Filming was fun when you had someone else to direct, and above all, it got Lucas out of his businessman funk. I could see George was looking for something else, said producer Rick McCallum. He wanted to be in a world where things weren't taken that seriously. Another factor driving the renaissance of Star Wars, McCallum himself. Lucas had met the American producer in the spring of 1984 while in London, visiting the set of Return to Oz, a dark and poorly received sequel to Wizard of Oz from Walter Murch and Gary Kurtz. Lucas had helped to bail them out of budget troubles. While visiting, he had wandered next door to the set of Dream Child, a biopic of Lewis Carroll by playwright Dennis Potter, which McCallum was producing, and looked wistfully at the small-scale production. When Lucas tapped McCallum for Young Indy, he had found his next Gary Kurtz, or rather, the producer he'd always wanted Kurtz to be. Someone who would move heaven and earth for the whims of George Lucas, communicate with the crew on his behalf, and, most importantly, keep a tight rein on time and budget. With a bruiser of a producer like McCallum, Lucas could return to directing. The great thing about Rick is that he never says no, Lucas told Marcus Hearn, author of The Cinema of George Lucas. He will screw his face up into a painful look, That's when I know I've gone too far, and he will eventually come back to me having found a way it can be done. If I don't want to shoot a particular scene tomorrow, but want something else, he'll say, okay. Then he'll work all night and move it all around. McCallum agreed that this was the job of a producer. Your talent, if you have any, is to enable the director to achieve everything he can, he said. You want him to win. The days when Lucas would have someone on set who would push back were long gone, and they weren't coming back. Actors wouldn't be a problem either. With more and more digital resources at his disposal, he could not only direct the movie in the editing room, the way he always did, but even move the actors' positions around in post-production. Star Wars fandom, meanwhile, was also pushing Lucas back toward the franchise. Aided by the explosion of the expanded universe during the early 1990s, the fans were back with a vengeance, and they were in Lucas's face. It was something he'd brought on himself. He had numbered the original trilogy 4, 5, and 6. Demand for 1, 2, and 3 became a steady drumbeat. The fans were getting older. They were watching the originals on VHS, and they were impatient. Pretty much everything Lucas had produced in the late 80s and early 90s, barring Indiana Jones, was a flop. But Star Wars was the nearest he had to a sure thing. It was, Lucas came to realize, his destiny. Part of the reason for doing it, Lucas said of the Star Wars prequels at a press conference for one of those flops, Radioland Murders, in October 1994, is that it's the first question I get asked. Not, this is who I am or anything, but, when are you going to do the next Star Wars? So, if I do the next ones, hopefully people will introduce themselves first. Lucas thought he could do the prequels cheaply and speedily. He would never go above $50 million per movie, he said. He would shoot them back to back, and then focus on the all-important CGI. The first one would arrive in 1997, he decided, the second in 1999, and the third in 2001. The story would then be told. The fans would be sated and civil. Lucasfilm would never again be weeks from not being able to make payroll, as it was several times during the 1980s, and he would finally be able to get back to those small experimental films. It would hopefully make me financially secure enough to where I wouldn't have to go to a studio and beg for money, he recalled to Charlie Rose in 2004, a year when he was still fully preoccupied with the prequel finishing task that should have been dispatched by 2001. Anyone sitting down to write a screenplay on November 1, 1994, as Lucas apparently did, would have been interrupted 8 days into the writing process by one of the most seismic midterm elections in post-war American history. Republicans took the House and the Senate for the first time in 40 years. A resurgent GOP under House Speaker Newt Gingrich started pushing its tax-cutting, regulation-slashing contract with America. Democrats, whose messaging had improved since Ted Kennedy's Star Wars flub, started calling it a contract on America. It was perhaps no coincidence, then, that Lucas started writing about a trade federation, aided and emboldened by corrupt politicians, embroiled in some sort of dispute over the taxing of trade to the outlying star systems. We never learned what the dispute was about, whether the trade federation was pro or anti-tax. But what we know is that the name of the leader of the trade federation, never actually spoken in the movie, but noted in the script from the start, was Newt Gunray. By 1997, when the GOP Senate leader was Trent Lott, Lucas had named the Trade Federation's representative in the Galactic Senate, Lott Dodd. We're a long way from the subtlety of his Vietnam metaphor here. The older Lucas got, the more overt his politics became. By 2012, he was openly siding with the Occupy Wall Street movement, describing himself as a dyed-in-the-wool 99%er before there was such a thing. It was increasingly clear to Lucas that his government had been bought by the rich, a process he abhorred. I'm a very ardent patriot, he told Charlie Rose, but I'm also a very ardent believer in democracy, not capitalist democracy. Asked by Rose why he didn't just make a political movie, Lucas explained that he had. The prequels were designed to subliminally convey the message of what happens to you if you've got a dysfunctional government that's corrupt and doesn't work. Contemporary politics weren't Lucas's only inspiration. He had brought out the secret file he'd been writing in since American Graffiti. There were folders marked Character, Plot, Outline, Jedi, Empire. The original notes for the prequels added up to 15 pages. There was plenty of drama inherent in those episodes. Anakin Skywalker would betray the Jedi Order somehow. But how? Why? The outline didn't always offer a lot of guidance. Here, for example, is what Lucas wrote for the man who was to become Darth Vader. Anakin Skywalker, age 9 to 20, a boy who builds droids and races power pods. 9 to 20? That's a pretty big range as far as movies go. This could be a children's racing movie in the style of Herbie the Love Bug, or an adult racing movie in the style of Days of Thunder. Earnest and hardworking, who dreams of becoming a star pilot and a Jedi, good at heart, blue eyes. Whenever he gets near a machine, he gets an intuition and he knows what makes it work. Is he a mutation? Who was his father? His mother, outcast. Lucas loved no part of the process more than research. His desk was replete with books. Your Child's Self-Esteem by Dorothy Briggs, and The Gnostic Gospels by Elaine Pagels. Simon Schama's Landscape and Memory, a sublime and meditative work on humans' relationship to nature. The two-volume Peasant Questions and Savage Myths, full of very strange historical folktales. The Hounds of Skaith, a science fiction novel by the late lamented Lee Brackett. Inherit the Stars, a science fiction novel published the same month as Star Wars. It was the first of a well-received trilogy. Lucas had likely been sitting with his books and his notes for some time before he brought the cameraman in to witness the screenplay's supposed birth on November 1, 1994. Once he decided to spring himself from the research trap and begin the screenplay of Episode 1 on that day, however, the creator wrote like the wind, 5 days a week. Decisions were made. The uncertainty collapsed. Anakin would spend Episode 1 at the age of 9, and then move up to 20 in Episode 2. Lucas briefly considered starting Anakin as an adolescent, but he decided that Anakin leaving his mother would have more impact if the kid was just 9. In theory, that made Episode 1 the story of how Anakin joined the Jedi Order. To fill it out, Lucas came up with what he has since variously described as a jazz riff and padding. When he realized his digital technology could take him to a place where his imagination was unbound, one of the first things Lucas saw was the pod race. The drag racing of his adolescence, but a kind of wacky races version that children would enjoy. He saw an entirely digital environment, the most thrilling natural racetrack in the universe. The plot would accommodate this somehow. As for the rest of it, well, Lucas could have structured Episode 1 using his old friend in Standby, The Hero's Journey, as elucidated by his third mentor. But who was the hero? Lucas seemed reluctant to decide. He'd often talked about doing the backstory of Obi-Wan Kenobi. That was his plan for the prequels as early as 1977. Obi-Wan as a young Jedi Knight. How he met Darth Vader. What happened when he fought in the Clone Wars. Over time, however, Lucas's intent shifted toward creating a 6-movie story arc that told the tragedy of Darth Vader. Was the hero Anakin then? Possibly. But in no draft of the script was Anakin on screen for the first 45 minutes. That's 3 times the length of time it took for us to meet Luke. Shorn of any kind of writing partner for the first time ever, Lucas returned to the anti-story approach of THX 1138 and applied it to a retelling of the original Star Wars trilogy. He was once again more interested in sound and vision than dialogue, and where he did use dialogue, it was as if he were writing a Dadaist William Burroughs-style cut-up poem made out of random words and phrases from the original trilogy. Wizard! It's a trap! How rude! Indeed, at various times during the production of Episode 1, Lucas referred to his script writing as poetry, a symphony, jazz, With THX, I became fascinated with that idea of visual jazz. Take the same idea and just riff on it visually, he said on the commentary track for the Episode 1 DVD. There's a lot of that going on in these movies. I like the idea of cyclical motifs that go on over and over. Later, he suggested, the films are primarily designed to be like silent films. Dialogue and effects are part of the musical composition. I'm telling the story visually rather than using a lot of heavy dialogue. The films are composed along lines of music. Many themes are going on through the films, and the themes repeat using different orchestrations. You have the same dialogue used by other characters in different situations, so you have a recurring theme going on constantly. The first example of a thematic note that Lucas offers is Obi-Wan's first line of dialogue. I have a bad feeling about this, which is how you might respond to the idea of building a 2-hour action-adventure movie on the notion of a jazz riff. Throughout much of the writing process, Episode 1 would simply be called The Beginning. There's one draft, marked January 13, 1995, which would be astonishingly fast if Lucas started on November 1, but it wouldn't be inconceivable, given Lucas's documented habit in later prequels of writing repeated, very fast drafts. Other dates that have been reported for drafts, June 13, 1996, for a revised, rough draft, the following March for a second draft, and May 1997 for a revised second draft. A third draft is dated May 13, 1997, and a revised third draft from June 6, 1997, 20 days before filming began. The first draft was markedly different from the final product. In the original Episode 1 script, Obi-Wan Kenobi has been sent alone by the Chancellor of the Galactic Republic to resolve the Trade Federation's blockade of the peaceful planet of Yutapau. There's that name from the original Star Wars again. The Trade Federation, persuaded by the mysterious Darth Sidious, a cloaked figure who is able to force-choke Newt Gunray long distance via hologram, attempts to assassinate Kenobi. The lone Jedi Knight escapes to the planet below and rescues a Gungan named Jar Jar Binks, who speaks in regular English sentences. With the help of the Gungan people, all of whom speak in regular English sentences, Kenobi travels through the ocean and the planet's core to the city of Naboo on the far side of the planet. There he rescues Queen Amidala and escapes with her retinue in a silver spaceship. Amidala repeatedly resists the notion of traveling with a Gungan. She physically shuns Jar Jar for most of the movie. With some interesting tension between Amidala and Obi-Wan, our heroes land for repairs on the backwater planet of Tatooine. Padme, supposedly the Queen's handmaiden, but in actual fact the Queen, is sent to join Obi-Wan and Jar Jar on a mission to look for parts. She deflects unwanted attention from local thugs with a little martial arts. A slave boy named Anakin saves Jar Jar's life and takes them back to his hovel, where he introduces his mother and a droid he's working on, 3PO, who is entirely mute. Anakin in this draft is full of ominous foresight. He claims to have seen Obi-Wan before in a dream, and Jesus-like forgiveness of his enemies, who tend to be in pain. He is wise beyond his years, as when he tells Padme, "We're helping each other. That's the natural way of things." When Padme asks Anakin if slavery is natural, Anakin responds, "Of course not, but the stupidity of many creatures is." He gives her a kiss on the cheek, and they watch the twin suns of Tatooine set. Before they leave the planet, Obi-Wan is attacked by a Sith Lord called Darth Maul. They have an exciting but inconclusive battle of Jedi powers, while vibrating to the point of becoming almost invisible. A Sith spacecraft follows the Queen and the Jedi to Coruscant, the galactic capital, and a planet city. The name was taken straight from Timothy Zahn's trilogy. On Coruscant, Anakin is taken for brief Jedi testing by Jedi Master Qui-Gon Jinn. Queen Amidala is refused permission to talk about the invasion of her planet before the Senate, so she gathers her forces and attempts to retake Yutapau herself, against Obi-Wan's advice. Padme and Jar Jar begin to develop common cause. Anakin helps out by evading the planet's blockade, bringing their ship out of hyperspace right above the surface, a miraculous feat that the ship's computers could not have achieved. He is apparently some kind of spatial savant. The Gungans come to the planet's aid after an impassioned speech by Jar Jar. Again, it's in proper English. "I have traveled far," muses Binks, as wise and solemn as Anakin. "I have seen many wonders. We must become a part of the universe. In isolation, we will die." He wishes Anakin well before they part for battle. "You are a wonder," says Binks, "and most amusing." The Gungans attack the droids en masse. Obi-Wan and Qui-Gon, who tagged along from Coruscant, liberate a planetary shield generator from a bunch of Trade Federation battle droids, taking the time to invoke Republic law and declare an illegal occupation. When the droids are defeated, Darth Maul attacks and kills Qui-Gon. Despite the shocking death of his elder Jedi, Kenobi seems perfectly happy to banter with Maul on the topic of education, Lucas's passion ever since he started his educational foundation in 1991, before casually slaughtering him. Obi-Wan: "Your style of fighting is old, but I understand it now." Maul: "You learn fast." Obi-Wan: "You don't bother to learn." Maul: "I don't have to." Obi-Wan slices the Sith in half. Obi-Wan: "Learn not, live not, my master always says." Anakin and Padme together deliver the killer blow to the orbital craft, he acting as pilot and her as gunner. There's a funeral for Qui-Gon, for which Yoda flies in, and the old Jedi announces that Obi-Wan can train Anakin. There's a victory parade, for which Utapau Senator Palpatine shows up and happens to mention that he's Supreme Chancellor now, though how he got the role isn't clear. You'd get a lot of agreement among Star Wars fans that what is described in that first draft sounds better than what ended up on the screen. There are only a few exceptions. The banter between Obi-Wan and Darth Maul, which seems inappropriate after the death of Obi-Wan's elder Jedi, and the lack of explanation for Palpatine's elevation. These hiccups were cleaned up in subsequent drafts. Trouble is, so much else got cleaned up too. Lucas's biggest change was to have Qui-Gon Jinn, now with a hyphen in his name, join Obi-Wan from the start, pushing him out of some scenes and distracting from what might otherwise be Obi-Wan's hero's journey. Obi-Wan was made to stay on the ship during the whole Tatooine sequence, in favor of Qui-Gon, and no longer developed any kind of connection to Anakin. Padme was delighted by Jar Jar, not repulsed. Anakin was transformed from an ominous young Buddha to an excitable drag racer, more like Lucas at that age, perhaps. The Jedi Council now had to tell us that the boy seems eerie because nothing in his actions suggested anymore. Lucas cut a scene in which Watto removes the slave transmitter from Anakin's neck, which would have made him more sympathetic. He cut Anakin's ability to make the ship appear out of hyperspace right next to the planet. Lucas seemed to be doing his damnedest to prevent Episode 1 from being either Anakin's or Obi-Wan's hero's journey. There were changes large and small that dumbed the script down. Lucas added a wisecracking, two-headed announcer to the pod race, rather than have Jabba the Hutt himself introduce the racers. And then there was the change that would cause Lucas no end of trouble, turning Jar Jar Binks from a wise, exiled English-speaking Gungan to a clumsy, buffoon-spouting pidgin English. Lucas says he modeled this new comic relief version of Binks on the great physical comedians of the silent era, Buster Keaton, Charlie Chaplin, Harold Lloyd, with a little Jimmy Stewart and Danny Kaye thrown in for good measure. But in his pratfalls, loping gait, and falsetto voice provided by a black actor, Ahmed Best, critics saw something far less benign. A CGI minstrel show, a Rastafarian step and fetch it, in the words of the Wall Street Journal's Joe Morgenstern, the first writer to make the comparison in his Phantom Menace review. Lucas and Best had to insist repeatedly that was not the intention. How in the world could you take an orange amphibian and say that he's a Jamaican? A frustrated Lucas thundered to the BBC shortly after Episode 1 came out. If you were to say those lines in Jamaican, they wouldn't be anything like the way Jar Jar Binks says them. His protests fell on largely deaf ears, however, partly because the problem of unintentionally racist caricatures cropped up twice more in the movie. The Neomoidians of the Trade Federation, Newt Gunray and his ilk, actually spoke with a soft Transylvanian accent. Critics saw their Imperial Chinese-style garb and heard Charlie Chan. Watto was speaking in a manner reminiscent of a gruff Italian shopkeeper. Critics noted his trunk-like nose and saw an anti-Semitic cartoon. Lucas was still pulling random items from his grab bag of influences, but this time the influences conspired to make Lucas appear racially tone-deaf. Why change Binks from sage to comedian in the first place? It seems Lucas was overly concerned about the prequels being darker than the original trilogy. They had to deal with the fall of the Old Republic, the fall of the Jedi, the rise of Vader, his all-but-destruction at the hands of Kenobi, the death of Luke and Leia's mother. Lucas seemed to be compensating with comedic moments, however ham-handedly. It wasn't just that he was trying to be his own Willard Hike or Lawrence Kasdan-style script polisher and joke teller. A man raising three children may get used to driving the nighttime terrors away with goofy jokes and silly voices. By the time Lucas had gotten around to the second draft, the movie he swore he would not make for more than $50 million was projected to cost $60 million. By the time he reached the fourth draft, that became $100 million, pretty much Lucas's entire fortune. Once more, Lucas was gambling all his chips. Here was his chance to fund Lucasfilm for a generation and to beat or come close to James Cameron's Titanic, the new king of the box office. Expected to be a monster flop, Cameron's epic had made a record-breaking $600 million gross in the United States alone in 1997. But perhaps most importantly, it was a chance to seal Lucas's place in history as a groundbreaking pioneer of digital cinema. But ILM's digital chops had yet to be tested when it came to creating the wild and wonderful creatures of space fantasy. What if there were a Star Wars movie they could practice on? What if they were to give the original movies, say, a digital makeover? 21. Special Edition. In April 1996, George Lucas attended a dinner at the home of filmmaker and USC friend Matthew Robbins in honor of Arthur Penn, famed director of dozens of films including the Dustin Hoffman as Native American picture Little Big Man, 1970. Penn was then in his 70s. The atmosphere was convivial, but Lucas sat down for dinner in a slightly irked mood. Now nearly 52, he had just spent $500,000 on a painting and worried that he had overpaid. He was wistful about the passing of time. "I used to be able to catch the arrows. Now I can't even see them going by," he said. "You wake up in the morning, then you go to bed. If you're lucky, you fit in lunch in between." To a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist who was present at the dinner, Lucas complained about media criticism of filmmakers, especially the flack Oliver Stone had received in 1992 for embellishing historical details in JFK. "How could the media judge? They were dealing less and less in reality." Lucas drew a box with his fingers on the table. "We do our work in here," he said, "and they're out there." Penn talked about the vagaries of filmmaking and how much was up to the fates. Little Big Man had been filmed in the snow, but then a Chinook wind came and melted it all. The crew had to wait around a month for more snow as the temperature plunged to 40 below. They tried a variety of fake snow. Nothing worked. "That's the difference between then and now," said Lucas, suddenly triumphant. If he were in that situation now, he could simply add snow in with CGI. "I'd just make it," he said. Penn, a filmmaking purist, looked aghast. He didn't say a word, but no one believed he would ever consider upgrading his movie with CGI snow. But for Lucas, CGI was a natural solution to all the challenges of filmmaking. He'd been an animator after all. That was the first class he took at USC, and it was the first career path he took outside of USC. By 1996, he was convinced there was nothing digital animation couldn't or shouldn't do. But an artist, even an animator, needs canvases to practice on. He was a year away from the start of shooting on the still unnamed Episode 1, which had been slated for release in 1997. By 1996, it was clear that date would have to be pushed back to 1999. To compensate, Lucasfilm coordinated an expanded universe event in 1996 in which variations on the same story, set after Empire Strikes Back, were told in a book, a comic, and a video game of the same name, Shadows of the Empire, described as a movie without a movie. In the meantime, there was a testbed for what CGI could do for Star Wars. Depending on your point of view, Lucas was either about to fix certain things that had long nagged him with modern tools, his equivalent of adding CGI snow to Little Big Man, or about to sacrifice his original movie on the altar of his new god, CGI. The truth of it depends a lot on your point of view. Lucasfilm lore suggests the special edition arose as a last-minute idea, and that part of the motivation was Lucas's desire to show his son Jet, who was 4 years old in 1997, the movies on the big screen. It has also been suggested that Lucas was spending his own money on the Episode 4 Special Edition. In fact, Lucas and Dennis Muren at ILM had been brainstorming how they might alter the original movie as early as 1993, the year Jet was born. Some restoration work needed to be done anyway. The negative was poor. It had been released in multiple versions. The audio had never been as good as Lucas intended, on neither the stereo nor the mono mixes, which in any case had slightly different dialogue. It was time to standardize the editions. And as for putting up the money, Fox, now owned by Rupert Murdoch, was paying for the Episode 4 revamp. The studio was happy to do anything Lucas wanted because it would help in the ongoing negotiations for the rights to distribute the prequels. Lucas would eventually give Fox those rights, but not before making Murdoch sweat by entertaining a bid from Warner Brothers. Lucas had long chafed at the fact that he hadn't been able to finish the original film the way he had wanted to. On one occasion, he called it a half-finished film. On another, he said it represented as little as 25% of his vision. "It's like a screen door that doesn't fit right," he explained to Newsweek. Initially, the list of shots Lucas and Muren discussed to fix the screen doors was relatively short, somewhere between 24 and 100. Then ILM started pointing out shots that could be cleaned up or altered or added or replaced. By the time the special edition was released in January 1997, the number of shots that had been altered in some way climbed to 277. It was as if Lucas had started with the screen door, overshot his goal, and ended up replacing the whole front of the house. Many of the fixes were extremely minor and only noticeable to film nerds. The wipes between scenes were cleaned up. Luke's landspeeder got a more realistic digital shadow, replacing a hand-drawn black line. The Dianoga, the monster in the trash compactor, was made to blink in the one shot where you can see its periscope eye. Some 23 shots saw minor content alterations, such as the addition of a floating probe droid in Mos Eisley. Another 37 shots received major alterations, the kind that fill most of the frame, and 17 shots were entirely new to the film. Most of these completely new shots came in a scene Lucas had shot but never used in 1976. It features Han Solo encountering Jabba the Hutt, played by portly actor Declan Mulholland, in a shaggy fur vest, just before Han boards the Millennium Falcon. The scene adds nothing to the plot that we're not told during Han's fateful meeting with Greedo in the cantina, which Lucas had specifically extended to cover key information after the Jabba scene was cut. Like the deleted scene with Luke and Biggs that would have killed the first reel, the Jabba scene adds a couple of minutes of padding to a taut and exciting action movie. Did restoring the Jabba sequence approximate Lucas's original intent? The answer isn't a clear-cut one, and it betrays the problem in trying to return to the messy process of making a movie 2 decades later. Yes, it does seem that Lucas originally considered making Jabba a puppet or stop-motion monster matted into the frame, erasing Mulholland. He asked Fox for an extra $80,000 in 1976 to cover both the Jabba scene and reshoots for the disappointing creature shots in the cantina. When Fox gave him just $40,000, Lucas spent it all on the cantina. He was ambivalent at best about Jabba's appearance. "If I had the money, I might have shot the Jabba special effect anyway," he recalled in 1982. "If it still didn't work, I'd have probably cut it out. The complexity of matting in a figure like Jabba, given that Han Solo has to walk all the way around him during the scene, made the model prohibitively expensive for a perfectionist like Lucas, even when he was rich. For the 1981 re-release of Star Wars, the one in which the movie officially became Episode 4, the notion of inserting Jabba went as far as someone in the art department drawing up storyboards. But even then, with Lucasfilm flush from The Empire Strikes Back, a special effects version of Jabba was considered either too expensive or too unimportant to even attempt. Curiously enough, given that she was the one who cut it out of the film, Marsha Lucas was much more gung-ho about the Jabba scene at the time than her husband. Her reasoning? Two words. Harrison Ford. "I thought it was a very virile moment," Marsha said in 1982. "It made him look like a real macho guy. Harrison's performance was very good. I lobbied to keep the scene." She genuinely enjoyed it from an aesthetic filmmaking perspective, too. Lucas uses a long lens to make Ford look sharp and large next to tiny Jabba in the distance. But every other actor in the scene looked like Greedo, she recalled, and George thought they looked pretty phony, so he had two reasons for wanting to cut the scene: the men and the pacing. You have to pick up the pacing in an action movie like Star Wars. But in 1997, pacing be damned. Lucas was too curious about what he could do with his new toolbox, and naturally those long-ago dreams of a monster Jabba interacting with Han Solo returned. Could his perfectionism be satisfied with CGI? The thing was to create a real Jabba the Hutt, Lucas told Wired in 2005. Not a big rubber thing, but a digital actual character. I figured if I could do that, then I could do everything else. CGI Jabba, effectively acting as ambassador for Jar Jar Binks, was duly wireframed in. To our eyes, two decades and a world full of CGI later, the 1997 version of Jabba looks crude, and not in a good old slimy Jabba kind of way. He's oddly antiseptic, unthreatening, and far smaller than the bloated version of the creature seen in Return of the Jedi. Lucas was happy enough with CGI Jabba in 1997, but not in 2004, when the creature got one more digital makeover for the DVD release. Fan favorite Boba Fett was also inserted into the scene, glaring at the camera at its conclusion, something Lucas most definitely didn't intend in 1976, given that Joe Johnston didn't design Fett until 1978. There's also one little bit of cleverness too far. In the scene as shot, Harrison Ford walks closely all the way around Mulholland. Lucas could have just had the Jabba character face in a different direction or move at the right moment to get out of Han's way. Instead, he had Han lifted up so that he appears to be stepping on Jabba's tail. It doesn't quite work from a visual perspective, falling into what roboticists and filmmakers call the uncanny valley. The gap between what looks real to our eyes and what looks artificial. It doesn't work from a plot perspective either. If Han's going to antagonize his business associate by stepping on his rear end, surely there needs to be some motivation for it. Instead, it just played as slapstick that makes Jabba squeal and his eyes bug out. There are quite a few new slapstick moments in the special edition. Vast beasts called Rontos are all over Mos Eisley, throwing their Jawa riders as if on cue. Dewbacks turn and growl at our heroes at just the right moment. Those animals moving actually distract from the principal purpose of the scene, Gary Kurtz complained. If it had been a Western and those were horses, chances are the horses would have just been sitting there because horses do that a lot. Though he lauded ILM's skills, Kurtz felt that it does not fit in with the mechanical style of the original film. Phil Tippett, who at this point had been appointed ILM visual effects supervisor, despite not having much love for the new computer-based techniques he was supervising, praised old Mos Eisley for being sparse, Western, and Sergio Leone-like. He once offered a succinct criticism of the CGI additions. They're shit. In 2014, when he was apparently in discussions about returning to work at Lucasfilm on Episode 7, Tippett told me he'd been kind of playing to the crowd when he made that choice summary. I didn't particularly care for the special editions, he said, but I didn't really care one way or the other. He's still not quite sold on the value of CGI, despite running a CGI shop at Tippett Studios. It's amazing what limitations can do for one's imagination, he says. The big fish doesn't work in Jaws. The alien doesn't work in Alien. What do? You have to work really hard to create suspense. For many special edition viewers, though, none of these alterations mattered as much as one amendment just before the Jabba encounter, during Han and Greedo's confrontation in the Mos Eisley Cantina. In the 1976 shooting script, when Greedo is threatening Han over some cargo for Jabba that apparently never got delivered, here's how the scene was written. Greedo, I've waited for this moment a long time. Han, yes, I'll bet you have. Suddenly, the slimy alien disappears in a blinding flash of light. Han pulls his smoking gun from beneath the table as the other patrons look on in bemused amazement. Han gets up and starts out of the cantina, flipping the bartender some coins as he leaves. Most moviegoers in 1977 saw that as a classic Western scene. The saloon gunfighter pulls a fast one on the bad guy and then casually compensates the barkeep for the mess. But in the 1997 version, Greedo was made to shoot a beat before Han, just missing his head. Han's shot was self-defense, although given that Greedo was pointing a gun at him and had just said Han was a dead man, it seems unlikely any court would have convicted Solo for murder in this situation. After controversy erupted among Star Wars fans over the shot, Lucas changed the scene again. In the 2011 Blu-ray version of Star Wars, the definitive version as far as Lucasfilm is concerned, Greedo's shot is moved forward by 11 frames so that he and Solo shoot practically at the same time. In a 2012 interview, Lucas claimed for the first time that in 1976 he had intended Greedo to shoot back and, evidently, to miss at point-blank range. The fan outrage over what became known as the Han shot first controversy, though that's a misnomer since Greedo didn't shoot at all originally, it would be better to call it Han shot Solo. Isn't all that interesting? What is interesting is how much Lucasfilm seems to have done to stoke the controversy over the following years. In 2005, Lucas was photographed on the set of Revenge of the Sith wearing a Han shot first t-shirt. He wore it again for 2007's Indiana Jones and the Kingdom of the Crystal Skull. A number of ILM animators kept Han shot first postcards above their cubicles while working on the prequel trilogy. Lucasfilm has approved Star Wars spin-offs across many forms of media that include winking references to the controversy as well. Multiple novels and videos, even the Lego Star Wars series, have made reference to Han shooting first and to Greedo's terrible aim. Lego Greedo is seen in the cantina performing poorly at darts. It's Solo, and he's shooting first, stormtroopers exclaim in the 2005 video game Battlefront 2. That's not fair! Changes aside, Lucas worried that the re-release of the original film would barely make its money back. The reason? We hadn't sold very many VHS tapes, he said in 2005. Although the video-buying public was warned that this was their last chance to own the original Star Wars on VHS, the 1995 release, Lucas says, only sold about 300,000 copies, or rather, the company had a perception that that's how well they'd done. Which is nothing compared to the 11 million that E.T. did, he added, still focused on the friendly rivalry with Spielberg. So I said that this would be an experiment, and hopefully, we'll get our money back. Perhaps for the sake of a good story, Lucas was minimizing his success. A total of 35 million VHS copies of Star Wars movies were sold by 1997. Fox would end up spending $7 million to do the restoration and digital work for the special edition, and another $3 million enhancing the sound. The outlay on the Star Wars special edition would be just short of the budget of the original film. But the expenditure was worth it, for Lucasfilm and its backers at least. The special edition release on January 31, 1997, would bring in more than triple Fox's investment in its opening weekend alone. $30 million more than its closest competitor, Jerry Maguire. In total, this re-release of Episode 4 alone grossed $138 million in the United States and another $118 million abroad. We have reached what is, in many ways, the tipping point of the whole Star Wars franchise. In 1996, Star Wars had not conquered our cultural universe. It may have become a best-selling title at the bookstore and in video games, and the original movies were certainly remembered fondly, with more movies on the horizon. But nobody had taken the temperature of the entire culture to see how much of a Star Wars fever it had. Once it was clear the series had power and longevity, to the point where it could make $90 million of pure profit from the restoration of one old movie, once it was proved a decades-old movie could completely dominate the box office and embarrass a really good contemporary movie like Jerry Maguire, everything changed. All of the forms of fandom explored in this book, the 501st, the Jedi Realists, the R2 Builders Club, and more besides, got their start around, or just after, 1997. Lucas, formerly a mere multimillionaire still struggling to pay off a divorce settlement, was secure and firmly on the road to billionairehood after 1997. And of course, this is the tipping point of CGI, which was to slowly swallow Star Wars special effects from this point on. The release of the special edition immediately touched off a debate in the media. Stories cropped up everywhere about Lucas and other artists retroactively changing their own work. We were invited to consider the French painter Pierre Bonnard, arrested for retouching his oil paintings in Paris's Luxembourg Museum. Bruckner revisiting his symphonies. Frank Zappa re-recording bass and drum parts for Mothers of Invention CDs. The same month as the Episode 4 Special Edition was released, a controversial Super Bowl ad showed Fred Astaire dancing on the ceiling with a dirt devil in his hand. The era of the digital retread had apparently begun. Rick McCallum was wheeled out to make the case for Lucas. "Does a filmmaker have the right to go back and get the film the original way he envisioned it?" he asked the Chicago Tribune. "Ask any director if he wanted to go back and fix a film, because of all the compromises he had to make, and he would." Outraged fans countered arguments like these by digging up testimony Lucas had given to Congress in March 1988, when he had gone along with Spielberg to protest the then-hot-button issue, Ted Turner's colorization of classic movies, including classics such as John Huston's The Maltese Falcon. Huston had protested to no effect. He no longer held the copyright. Lucas was incensed. "People who alter or destroy works of art and our cultural heritage for profit or as an exercise of power are barbarians," he fumed. "In the future, it will become even easier for old negatives to become lost and be replaced by new altered negatives. This would be a great loss to our society." Lucas's testimony had another theme running through it, however, a theme that Lucas had been remarkably consistent on throughout his life: the power of the creator to be the ultimate arbiter of his work. Could Huston himself have colorized The Maltese Falcon 2 decades after releasing it, if he'd so wished? For Lucas, the answer would have to be yes. The more troubling aspect of the whole affair, with shades of 1984, was the fact that Lucas's original negative was to remain hidden away from the public at Skywalker Ranch, with instructions that it never be shown. "To me, it doesn't really exist anymore," Lucas said in 2004. Luckily, the 1977 negative has also been preserved in the Library of Congress's National Film Registry, which has now made a high-definition 4K digital transfer of it. The Library of Congress has never screened it because the rights holder, Lucasfilm, will not allow it. Researchers can make appointments to view it at the Moving Image Research Center in Washington, D.C. But for the casual viewer, it may as well not exist. Pull a DVD or Blu-ray off the shelf and you're getting a special edition, albeit in a slightly different version depending on when you bought it. Lucas's stubbornness on his right to keep digitally altering his films put him out of step with his friends. Spielberg digitally altered E.T. for its 20th anniversary edition in 2002, turning the guns of FBI agents into walkie-talkies. He later declared that he was disappointed in myself for doing so, and reverted to the original version for the Blu-ray release. But even the changed version of E.T. had been sold alongside the original as part of a two-disc DVD set. Dennis Muren, the ILM mastermind who got the ball rolling on the special edition, assumed the same would happen with Star Wars. I felt that so long as the originals were around for people to see, that redoing them was okay, he said in 2004. But that was never Lucas's intention. Drawing contrast with Blade Runner, which he derided as having been released 6 ways from Sunday, Lucas insisted that there was only one Star Wars. All the accumulated changes piled on over the years, the 1978 audio remixing, the 1981 Episode 4 edition, the 1997 Special Edition, the 2004 DVD release, the 2006 DVD re-release, the 2011 Blu-ray release, all amounted to a single film slowly progressing toward realization. The time gap didn't matter. Approximating the creator's original intent as determined by the creator was all that counted. In 1997, Lucas pointed out that the VHS tapes would degrade in a few decades. The special edition would remain in digital form for future generations. His attitude never changed, and he would only grow more tetchy on the subject. Here's what Lucas had to say to fans in 2004. I'm sorry you saw a half-completed film and fell in love with it, but I want it to be the way I want it to be. I'm the one who has to take responsibility for it. I'm the one who has to have everybody throw rocks at me all the time. So at least if they're going to throw rocks at me, they're going to throw rocks at me for something I love rather than something I think is not very good, or at least something I think is not finished. After multiple online petitions for such a thing gained tens of thousands of signatures, a poor quality version of the 1977 print was placed on a bonus disc as part of the 2006 DVD re-release. Lucas insisted that he would not spend the millions necessary to restore it. So, fans did it for him, in an incalculable number of digitally altered, de-specialized editions, available in the darker corners of the internet, each one slightly different from the next, according to the whims of the editor. Lucas's insistence on a single standardized version of Star Wars has ironically led to Star Wars being available 600 ways from Sunday. A month after the first special edition hit theaters in late January 1997, Lucasfilm released a special edition of Empire Strikes Back. The film quickly claimed the number one box office position from its predecessor. It contained few noticeable changes, other than dubbing in Ian McDiarmid's voice for the hologram of the Emperor. His face would not be added until the DVD version in 2004, and fleshing out the Wampa that attacks Luke on the ice planet of Hoth, another monster breathing a little bit more life. Otherwise, it merely cleaned up the special effects. Was Lucas still displaying reverence toward Kirsch? Or was this a recognition that Empire was the most perfect film in the series and didn't need any amendments? Certainly, there was a little less reverence displayed toward Return of the Jedi. For that re-release, Lucas replaced the music sequence in Jabba's palace. A 3-minute song called Laptinek, which had been written by Hardware War's Ernie Fasellius and performed by a puppet called Cy Snoodles, with a CGI Snoodles singing a song called Jedi Rocks, written by jazz trumpeter Jerry Hay. Snoodles' band gained 9 new CGI members. To be fair to Lucas, even Laptinek had been a replacement for a track written by John Williams and sung by his son. It was a song derided by Richard Marquand for being a little bit too disco. Most crucially for the plot, Lucas added scenes of celebration around the galaxy after the second Death Star was destroyed, conveying for the first time the notion that the Empire actually had been fully defeated. The expanded universe, the existence of which largely depended on the Empire not being defeated at the end of the movie, fought back. The comic book Mara Jade, by the Emperor's hand, featured one Imperial officer telling another that they'd rounded up all subversives involved in victory celebrations. The special editions of Empire and Jedi cost roughly $5 million each, with Lucasfilm footing the bill for both. They grossed $67 million and $45 million in the United States, respectively, and $57 million and $44 million abroad. The Episode 4 Special Edition was so popular that it would help the movie regain the title of highest-grossing film of all time from Spielberg's E.T. Star Wars would hold the title only fleetingly. James Cameron's Titanic set sail in December 1997. Destination, highest-grossing movie of all time, until the next one. That ongoing rivalry between the two friends' highest-grossing movies might help explain why Lucas was so insistent on having one definitive version of Star Wars. If the 1977 and 1997 versions were counted separately, Lucas would never have regained the top spot. It would have been hard for the heads of Lucasfilm not to absorb the lesson that the more bold and controversial the CGI, the bigger the gross. The success of that re-release not only told me that I could create these creatures and build better sets and towns than I could before, said Lucas in 2005, but that the Star Wars audience was still alive. It hadn't completely disappeared after 15 years. I decided that if I didn't do the backstory then, I never would, so I committed to it. Lucas's chronology here may be a little confused. By 1997, he was as deeply committed to Episode 1 as he had been to the original movie. He was into his third calendar year of writing, and his third draft when the special edition came out. He had in fact confirmed that he himself would be directing the still untitled movie back in September 1996. Character designs, such as the villainous Sith, Darth Maul, had been fully fleshed out by that time. Concept designer Ian McKaig had been asked to draw the scariest thing he could think of. Lucas deemed the result, a pasty white creature with blood-red ribbons for his hair, too scary by far. Back at the drawing board, McKaig sketched out his second scariest idea. A circus clown in black and red makeup, feathers tied to his head with elastic, a feature that McKaig said would make him irritable. When feathers became horns, one of the most iconic characters of the prequels sprung to life. For a weapon, Maul was given a double-bladed lightsaber, originally designed by artist Christian Gossett for the expanded universe comic Tales of the Jedi. Gossett would have to expend some energy in later years, proving that he came up with the concept for the comic and had it approved by Lucas in 1994, and that it had not, as another designer once claimed in an interview, sprung from Lucas's imagination. Meanwhile, casting director Robin Gerland had been rounding up actors since 1995. This time, it seemed like less consideration was given to the chemistry between the actors and more to getting the biggest names imaginable. There wasn't an actor on the planet uninterested in appearing in the next Star Wars movie. In December 1996, Samuel L. Jackson had announced his intention to be cast in the movie on the British TV chat show TFI Friday. Jackson won his campaign some 6 months later, along with the star of the Academy Award-winning Schindler's List, 1994, Liam Neeson, and rising teen actor Natalie Portman. Ian McDiarmid would return to play Senator Palpatine, this time without makeup. He was finally the right age. Jake Lloyd, an 8-year-old who had been cast as Arnold Schwarzenegger's son in the holiday movie Jingle All the Way, 1996, would play Anakin. Ewan McGregor, who had just burst onto the international scene with Trainspotting, 1996, rounded out the big-name principals, this who's who of 1990s cinema. A major fan of the original trilogy, McGregor recalled playing all the parts in the playground as a child, including Princess Leia. He said he'd been deeply in love with Leia for many years. Part of what sold Lucas on McGregor was his family connection to the original trilogy. His uncle, Dennis Lawson, had played Wedge Antilles, the only rebel pilot to survive all three films. Lightsaber fighting on the set one day, switching from the clipped tones of Alec Guinness to his thick Perthshire accent as soon as Lucas's assistant yelled, "Cut!" McGregor recalled the moment he got the casting call. "Do you want to do Star Wars?" they said. I said, "Too fucking right!" He wouldn't be quite so enthusiastic when he saw the result. 22. The Line. The filming of Episode 1, directed according to its mischievous clapperboards by Yoda, began on June 26, 1997. Though Lucasfilm had leased Leavesden Studios in London for 2.5 years, nearly all of that time was set aside for the grab bag of occasional last-minute shots known as pickups. Lucas and producer Rick